Sergeant Pepper still matters to us because even 40 years later, it stands as an example of how to balance risk-taping with songcraft. And by that, I mean...
You said risk-taping. Say that again.
Okay. I'm going to start over, Paul. Forgive me. Sergeant Pepper still matters 40 years later because it's a record that still endures as an almost ideal balance between risk-taking and songcraft. The Beatles had established themselves, of course, as premier songwriters from virtually the moment that they started recording, but the studio techniques that they were using were getting more sophisticated really by the month when you look at it session by session. But I think the very biggest leap occurred between late August 1966, which is when they did their last concert, and when they re-entered the studio after a few months' absence to start work on Strawberry Fields Forever. It's almost like one door had shut on the previous era and another door had opened. Now, of course, in Revolver, there had been some very ambitious tracks like Eleanor Rigby and Tomorrow Never Knows, but with Strawberry Fields Forever, they had a great song, but instead of taking the attitude they might have taken only like a year or two before, like let's work on it for a day or two and get our best version, they worked on it for like a month's worth of sessions. They scrapped a finished recording once or twice to start almost from scratch again and then combine the best two recordings because they had a sound they could hear in their head that could only be achieved by layering elements in the studio and working until they had combined everything just right. But they never lost sight of the great song that was beneath that. And they kept doing that over and over the course of the next few months where they were recording Sgt. Pepper, Penny Lane, which was used as the B-side, well, as the other side of Strawberry Fields Forever. It was a double A-side, really.
You popped on Penny Lane, so say that it started there.
Okay. They did that with other songs besides Strawberry Fields Forever. On Penny Lane, which was the other side of the single, that's an equally brilliant song, and it wasn't quite as involved as Sgt. Pepper, but again, there were a lot of decisions that they made, a lot of different kinds of orchestration they were using. They never buried the song. I think you can say that about all the songs on Sgt. Pepper, even what is probably the most ambitious recording of that whole era, A Day in the Life. The song was always there. The studio techniques were used just to bring out the most in the song in a way that hadn't been done before. By that I mean nobody had gone off the road, almost retired from live performance virtually, except for some promo films and TV appearances, and spent so much time in the studio making things the way they wanted it to be, not worrying really about the clock or about EMI's record demands. I think it set a new standard for I think Sgt. Pepper set a new standard for what groups could maybe demand isn't the right word, almost require from their record company, from their management, from their fans, in terms of being true to their creative hearts. By that I mean, at this point, at least in the Beatles' career, their hearts were not in live performance because they couldn't hear themselves and they couldn't be heard and a lot of their material couldn't translate well to a concert environment. Now, almost any other group in that position in 1966 would have bowed down to a record company demand saying, well, we don't care, we need this next album next month, or their management saying, we don't care, we have all these offers to tour all around the world, we've got to capitalize upon that right now. They said, we are going into the studio until we come out with the record that we want. I mean, they probably didn't say that in those words, but that's what their actions bespoke, really. And I think it set an example to a lot of their other artists around that time. Even the very biggest ones were still going in and out of the studio. If you look at what Cream was doing in the studio, they were just snatching time in New York and London as they could. But for instance, Jimi Hendrix, when he did Electric Ladyland, he had that attitude too, that we're going to stay here until we get it right. And it's going up to the present day when a group maybe has a very ambitious concept in mind or a recording they want to do in a certain way. I think they feel more of a sense of entitlement to say to themselves and to the business machine that surrounds them, we're going to spend as much time as we can to get this right. But I think there's another, like, less cerebral inspiration that comes out of Sgt. Pepper that might be in danger of getting lost these days, which is, for all the ambition of the record, the Beatles were kind of not afraid to take these risks and, in a sense, kind of make risk-making fools of themselves, because what they were doing was so contrary to what the Beatles' previous image had been. This even goes all the way down to the record cover, where they're in these very garish costumes, and there are all these cutouts of historical figures. I think a lot of acts these days would be like, you know, maybe we're going to look silly. Maybe it's just not going to look hip. Maybe it's, you know, not going to be considered, like, underground enough. We can't risk, you know, being silly or being playful. But the Beatles didn't seem to really care about that, and they kind of flew with their inspiration, and it worked out really, really well for both them and their fans. Of course, they had a lot of great songwriting and production skill going for them, which a lot of bands who do take risks don't have, so it's not always going to come off. But looking at bands these days, I kind of wish that more of them would take such risks and not worry so much about what people are going to think and whether they're going to be perceived to be foolish or something like that. I first heard Sgt. Pepper, it was probably 1969, because my oldest brother, who's 9 years older than I am, had a copy of the record, and we were able to hear it when he wasn't around. And at that point, I guess my attraction to the Beatles, like a lot of very young kids who were getting into the Beatles at that time, was the melodies, the songs, and the likability of their voices and their vocal harmonies. It really took about 3 or 4 more years to appreciate the fuller extent of what they were doing, both in terms of the lyrics and in terms of how they were recasting their image. But I have to say that even though, you know, even by the time I was 10 or 11, the reality is in this country, I was becoming aware of drug use and what that meant. It never struck me like as an album, like, oh, I can't wait till I can smoke pot so I can get high to this record. That's the way you've got to hear it. I could appreciate that some of those influences were at work in getting the music to sound the way it did with the Beatles' experimentation with drugs. But it seemed to me that you never needed drugs to really enjoy the album to the fullest, because the psychedelic element of the record, to me, is not so much in drug references, which are pretty mild when you look at the lyrics. It's more in the juxtaposition of elements where you never know, certainly the first few times you listen to it the whole way through, what's coming around the corner. And it seems like the Beatles are encompassing everything about 20th century music, but always sounding like themselves. That's the genius of it. Even when they're doing kind of circus music in Mr. Kite, chamber music in She's Leaving Home, those dissonant orchestral crescendos in A Day in the Life, they always still sound like themselves, and they're always still sounding very likable, even when they're going into very disturbing topics. Some people might see that as sappy, but I see that as a very engaging quality of the Beatles, where they could spread these ideas without putting off people who were maybe just dipping their toes into it and afraid to take the full plunge. Pepper made them take that full plunge, but people probably weren't even aware that it was, like, you know, this really bold thing to do because it was so pleasant. When I think of sections of Sgt. Pepper that really strike me, even 40 years later, one that comes to mind is a song that's not discussed too often. A lot of people talk about A Day in the Life and how it combines a couple of different songs into one, and it simulates disaster and a drug trip, and that's very interesting. But one of my favorite songs on the record is Lovely Rita. It doesn't get too much attention relative to the others. And I really like that section toward the end when, after this very cheery, nice song, all of a sudden it hits these very, like, disturbing, almost dissonant notes, and the Beatles start to make kind of funny mouth noises in the background. And right when it gets to the point where it seems like they're going off into a really bad trip, all of a sudden there's, like, a really long glissando run down the piano, and it comes to an end. And that's an example, I think, of almost a sly subversion of the Beatles during this era, certainly, where what you think is going to happen often doesn't, or it leads off into a totally different direction, which makes you think, well, you know, is this song really that innocuous after all, or is it really that dangerous after all? Another one that I like, this is, you know, something that's going to be referred to more commonly, I think, but the very first section of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, where you just hear that riff, it's almost like hearing a classical music song, even though John Lennon, who was the principal or sole author of that tune, he didn't have classical training. He wasn't a classical music fan. But I heard a comment by George Martin about that little passage once, and he said, you know, that's something that Beethoven would have been proud of. You know, he didn't say Beethoven would have been proud of. He said, you know, Beethoven wouldn't have minded using that riff. It's that almost like elemental but graceful. It doesn't sound like the rock and roll that John Lennon had grown up with and had pretty much inspired him to start being a musician. It's something that's totally different to most of what he had written before. And it's very lovely, although it quickly, you know, just becomes more a part of a more conventional song with lyrics. Again, we're talking instrumental sections, but the parts in Mr. Kite, where all of a sudden the circus takes over the instrumental break and toward the end, because, again, they sound like a circus, but they kind of don't. And that's a way that the Beatles were kind of mirroring a drug experience without you having to take drugs, because it was like a circus, but it was like a circus of the mind. You never go to a circus where they're going to be using that soundtrack because it's just too weird and disturbing in some ways. But it sounds like a circus, and it sounds like almost like the circus that's going on inside of their minds when they're trying to deal with all these changes that are happening to them and the world. It's a very thrilling sequence, both the instrumental break in the middle and that final bit at the end, and has very little to do with rock and roll. I find it very interesting that they're able to incorporate those kinds of musical idioms so almost effortlessly, it seems, although now that we know a lot about the recording sessions, we know a lot of effort was involved and that they actually threw up pieces of tape in the air to help get those effects. Although even though we know now that there was a lot of effort involved in getting those instrumental sections of Mr. Kite, they actually threw pieces of tape up in the air and edited them back together so they sounded differently than a real circus, kind of the same, but kind of differently. But the way it sounds on the record, you don't hear that self-consciousness about the process. It just sounds like all of a sudden you're in this alternate reality circus. An interesting thing about Sgt. Pepper, it seems to me, is that it's not the Beatles' best album as individual songs. I think that you'll find a lot of Beatles fans and experts saying they prefer Revolver or Abbey Road or the White Album, because the songs in general, it can be argued at least, are stronger on those records than they are on Sgt. Pepper. Some of the individual songs on Sgt. Pepper, if they were taken out of the record, I don't think they would be, they're all good to me, but I don't think they would be nearly as effective. Like When I'm 64, it's a little corny. Within You, Without You, George Harrison's getting a little indulgent in his love of Indian music. The reprise of Sgt. Pepper, it's very short, and it wouldn't make much sense out of context of the record. But I think as a whole, the album's as good as any LP that the Beatles did, because it was more than the sum of the songs, more than any other Beatles record, I think. It was also in the way that they were combined together, also the way that they were edited together, where in some instances you're almost like being, there's no word like glid, but the record is gliding you from one mood to another, kind of in a very thrilling way, but in a way that feels very natural. I'm thinking of the transition between the first track, Sgt. Pepper itself, and With a Little Help from My Friends, and also the way that the reprise of Sgt. Pepper suddenly, you know, it's a very upbeat, almost live concert mood. Suddenly it goes into a much more meditative mood, and you know that it's not really like, it hasn't really just been this show by the Sgt. Pepper band. Something really serious is about to happen, and indeed it does with A Day in the Life. a very groundbreaking aspect of Sgt. Pepper was that so much time and studio technology was involved. It might seem a little primitive now, but by the standards of late 66 and early 1967, it was at the very forefront of what was possible. When you look or listen to the outtakes from that record, both the ones that have been released on the anthology series and also the ones which have come out on bootleg, what's evident is when you compare it to previous Beatles outtakes, they don't seem like nearly as much of songs as they do when you listen to certainly a Beatles outtake from 63 or 1964 or even from Rubber Soul. They're not going for complete performances so much as really layering elements like a really huge wedding cake. And it's a process that leads to very satisfying, yummy results. But when you listen to the outtakes, 1967 is the least interesting year of the Beatles' career because they're not very partial, they're not complete in their nature. You'll hear, you know, a harpsichord in isolation or a backing track for Good Morning, Good Morning, or a different mix of A Day in the Life, which is just a little bit different. And it's not nearly as interesting as, say, hearing their White Album demos, where they're acoustic versions and they're way different from the familiar versions from the White Album. I think it's a testament to how complicated the process was of doing the record. And it was never more complicated than it was for the process was never more complicated than it was for Strawberry Fields Forever. Now, the general fan doesn't think of that as a Sgt. Pepper song, but it's important to point out that it was originally intended for the LP, and it was kind of snatched from the LP because they needed a single because there had been no Beatles record for 6 months. But it was the first track they started to work on during the Sgt. Pepper sessions. I don't think a lot of people realize there is a whole CD of different versions of Strawberry Fields Forever. From the time that John Lennon was playing it on acoustic guitar in his hotel room in Spain, where he was filming How I Won the War, until the final track. There was like 70 minutes of this stuff. And it's a testament to how much they were tinkering with songs by that point. They would never, as great a song as something like She Loves You is or A Hard Day's Night, they would have never spent 10 weeks or however long that period spans just tinkering with one song and different arrangements. But when it got to the point of Strawberry Fields and A Day in the Life, it was really necessary to do that in accordance with where the Beatles' heads were at that time. Because, as I've said before in our conversation, it was really a time when they were striving to get both new sounds and get a sound on tape that they had heard in their head, but which not only they had never recorded before, but nobody had ever recorded before.